And if you're standing here with us, you can go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 10 and 11, where we're going to be this morning. I want to let you know my family and I are going to be out of town the next few days, so if you try to get a hold of me, I may not answer. I may get back with you if I need to, but we'll be gone through Wednesday and be back later in the week. Going to take some time away as a family. So this morning in Genesis chapter 10 is where we're going to be, and we've started at the beginning of the year talking about where we all came from and what this is all about. And we titled this The Beginning of Redemption. The Bible is the whole story of how God is redeeming his people. And so God, in the beginning, created everything that there is. He rules over it. He spoke it into existence. And he created humanity, we looked at Adam and Eve, and he created them in his image, right? We were meant as humans to live on this earth as representatives and to look like God on this earth. And we know the story up to this point is that humans did not do that, right? We broke the image of God. We did all kinds of things to sin and break that image. And it got so bad, we saw a couple weeks ago, that God regretted that he had ever made humanity, right? And he sent out, he poured out his judgment and his mercy in the form of a flood, right? He wiped out humanity and started over, and he saved one family, Noah and his family, because Noah was righteous. And last week we looked at Noah and his family. They get off the ark, right? And they are going to begin again. The eight of them are starting over, and all the pairs of the animals. And they begin to multiply and to fill the earth. And what we really saw last week was that Noah and his family are really no different than Adam and his family. And they're really no different than your family and my family, right? They're broken. The flood did all kinds of things to change the earth, but it never changed the human heart, right? And so these humans that God has created in his image, their heart is filled with sin. And we're going to see today what is the world that they create as they multiply and fill the earth. What's it going to be? Is this going to be different? Is Noah's descendants going to be different than Adam's descendants? Let's look at it together. Let's start in Genesis chapter 10. Now, some of you looked ahead and you're going, there's no way you're about to pronounce all these words. And you're right. I certainly am not today. But let's read a few key verses so you get a gist of what Genesis 10 is about. Starting verse 1, it says, these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Sons were born to them after the flood. And it says, the sons of Japheth, and he lists off a bunch of them, Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshech and Tirath. Anybody pregnant in the room still trying to figure out some names? We got a whole host of them here today. So Japheth has a whole line, and he lays out all the different sons of Japheth. And then he goes in verse 6 and lays out the sons of Ham, Cush and Egypt and Put and Canaan. That one's going to be important. In verse 21, verse 21 says, to Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the elder brother of Japheth, children were born. And then at the very end, we see verse 32. These are the clans of the sons of Noah according to their genealogies in their nations. And from these, the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. In our verses today, you can go read them today, right, in chapter 10. We see this. We see this picture of how humanity multiplies, how it continues to multiply and fill the earth, but how it continues to rebel against God. And in chapter 12, Shane's actually going to preach for us next week in chapter 12. It's going to deal with God's solution to the problem. What was God's solution to the problem in the flood? It was a covenant. And the same thing's going to happen in Genesis chapter 12 with Abram. God's going to lay out a covenant. But today, we're not going to read all these names. We're not going to read all these details. Chapter 10 is often called the Table of Nations, the Table of Nations. And it lays out these 70 nations, that these 70 peoples that come from Noah and his family. It describes some of where they lived and where they spread out. Now, I read this week, and I'm thinking, this doesn't make any sense, because in chapter 11, it's going to say they were all together, and that's true, right? These really are reversed in chronological order. Chapter 10 describes the big picture of where all the different people settled and all that they went after the flood, and chapter 11 is going to give us the reason why these nations spread out and formed. There's three things I want you to learn from chapter 10. It's this. Number one, God is God of the nations. God is the God of the nations. Number two, we're going to talk about the geography a little bit. And number three, we're going to talk about the lineage. So first, God is the God of the nations. Before God is the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and now us, God is the God of all of these nations, all 70 of these. And if you read many of these names, you're going to hear names that you think of in a negative light. You think of them as the enemies of God's people, people that are far away from God, the Girgashites and the Perizzites and all these different people, right? You read them and you think, man, those are evil people. I can't imagine where they came from. You know where they came from? They came from Noah. They came from Shem, Ham, and Japheth, right? None of these nations are mentioned in a positive light, and it's so easy for us to just kind of write them off today, but each one of them comes from Noah. Each one of them comes through Adam, through Seth, down to Noah, and each one of these, though they are sinners and enemies of God, they are sons and daughters of God. God is a God of the nations from the very, very beginning. Why? Because the nations are the image bearers of Him, right? They are loved by God. Before He's the God of Abram, He is the God of all humanity. And that's true today. God never intended to just love one people, one ethnicity, one people group, right? No, He is the God of all the nations. He loves and He cares for every human being. Though they fall away, though they reject Him, though they do all kinds of things, God desires to save the nations, right? This is the true, even today. This is why we send missionaries to the ends of the earth. This is why my dad is in Africa today. This is why many give their lives in this, because we believe that God is not just the God of us. This isn't just, hey, let's get a bunch of people in a room and let's shut this thing down. This is where God's presence is and is only. No, we believe that God is the God of the nations. We care about those that are our brothers and sisters all around the world. Why? Because they too bear the image of God. Okay? So that's one thing we should learn from chapter 10. Well, another thing we should learn is a little bit of the geography. My dad loved maps. Y'all remember that? Remember that? Any of you who were here some of those years? He loved maps, right? So I thought, let's throw it back a little bit. Let's put a little map on the screen, right? Not that you can see this from where you're sitting, but here's a little bit of, because you're wondering, how did this happen? Where is Mount Ararat and all that, right? So when Noah gets off the boat, the Bible says that it's in Mount Ararat, or the Ararat Mountains. This is like far eastern Turkey, the modern day country of Armenia. Anybody ever heard of Armenia in the room today? Oh, you must have, yeah. There we go. We got a couple educated people in the room. They land on Mount Ararat, but over time they begin to spread out. Before they really spread out, they congregate in a place called the Plain of Shinar. We're going to study it here in a minute in chapter 11. That's the little star on the map. It's Mesopotamia. It's between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. It's modern-day Baghdad. Okay? Just a little tidbit of info. But over time, Ham's descendants settle in Canaan, what we would call modern-day Israel or Palestine, near the east side of the Mediterranean Sea. How many of you, when I say east, have any concept of what direction that is? To the right on this map, okay? Shem and his descendants, which is he's going to be the blessed line, they settle in Mesopotamia around Babel that we're going to talk about today, between the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, right? Modern day Iraq. And Japheth and his descendants go west, that's to the left on this map, to like Turkey and Europe. None of this matters. It does, but it doesn't. Now, many of Ham's descendants, if you remember the story from last week, become the future enemies of the people of Israel, the ones that go to the land of Canaan. Canaan is Ham's first son. And Shem kind of stays in Babylon. And eventually, out of this line is where Abram's going to come as from Ur of the Chaldeans, is what it says. It's just a little south of where it says Nimrod on the map. The problem at this point is not that there's too many people or too much, there's really too much land. And so they are called to do what? To fill the earth with the image of God, to fill the earth with the knowledge of God. And eventually they begin to do that. In chapter 10 and all throughout Genesis, the third thing we're meant to learn is lineage. Now, when I was little, my Mimi loved, what do they call it? We don't use the word lineage. What's the term I'm thinking of? You know, ancestry. This was before ancestry.com. But she and her sister had this book that they had done all this research on, right? And they loved to sit us down and talk about, hey, we were related to so-and-so, and they came over on the Mayflower, and eventually it goes all the way back to this king and whatever. I'm like, this is a bunch of baloney, right? There's no way this is true. We have no idea where we came from. I don't know. We came from Wichita Falls. That's all I know. Why does Genesis spend so much time on lineage? On this father had this son and these sons, and then he had this and this and this. Why does that matter so much to the Genesis story? Why does Moses spend so much time tracing the line of Shem, tracing the line of Seth, tracing the line of Noah? Why? Because remember the promise from Genesis 3? What was God's promise? That one day he would send a son, right? One day there would be a son in this line who would come and fix their big problem. What's their big problem? Their separation from God, their brokenness because of sin. And so when they're tracing lineage, this is not my Mimi just excited because she got a free ancestry.com account. This matters because to them, this is God's plan of salvation. And so Moses is not just doing this because he wants me to have a hard time pronouncing some names today. He's doing this because he's showing God is being faithful to his promise. God is working his plan. He's remembering his covenant to save his people. And every time that there's a problem, and that's kind of where we're going to be today, we're going to look at some of the brokenness. The next thing that happens in Genesis is a covenant, is a promise, right? And that's going to be next week. We're going to look at Genesis chapter 12. There's a lot of missing detail. There's a lot of other things you can go look at in chapter 10. But the big picture is this. Humanity eventually does spread out, and it does fill the earth. But they don't do it because they want to. They do it because God forces them to. And that's what chapter 11 is about. God's going to force them to do what he called them to do. So let's look at it together. Story of the Tower of Babel. Look at verse 1. It says, "Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth.' And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, 'Behold, they are one people, and they all have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. So come, let us go down and confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech.' And so the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, which means confusion, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth." So as Noah and his sons get off the boat, eventually they multiply and there becomes more and more people. And they settle in this place called Shinar, right between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. It's modern day Iraq near Baghdad. And they're in this incredibly fertile place. And they're all together. They have one language. And in time, they developed a new technology, bricks, right? You don't think of bricks as technology. You think of phones and other things. But for them, this was brand new technology. In Israel, they would have built with stone and mortar. But over here in the East, they began to create these things called bricks. And it allowed them to build things that were bigger than you could do with stone, right? Because it had a sturdiness and it had a uniformity to it. And they're all together and they're using this new technology. Is technology bad? No, not necessarily. Can we use technology for good? Absolutely. Can we use it for bad? Absolutely. And in here, they did use it for bad. There's a man, you can go read about him in chapter 10. His name is Nimrod. Anybody looking for a baby name? Don't use this one, all right? This man named Nimrod, and he's a part of this project of building this. He's described as this mighty man, and there's all these words used to describe him that's associated with strength and might. He may be even a giant of sorts. And he is kind of the one credited with building this city. In reality, they think of it as strong. They think of it as this human accomplishment. Look what we've done. We've built, we've used this technology, and look what all that we have done. But in reality, their best achievement is against God and is tiny compared to God. And here's the key verse. Look at verse 4. It says, "Then they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth.'" See, humanity has this unity, and they came together for this purpose. And we read this at first, and you may just go, "What's the big deal? Why is a tower wrong? Why is using brick wrong? I don't understand why God does what he does." But you can see it in this verse 4. First, they wanted the top of the tower to be where? In the heavens. What was the realm that God had given humanity? The earth. And whose was the heavens? God, right? And so by saying we're gonna extend our reign to the heavens, they are claiming ownership of the heavens, but they're also claiming and aiming to be like God, right? What was the fall like? My brain's not working. What did the enemy tempt Adam and Eve with? If he knows if you'll eat this fruit, you will be what? Like God. And they already were like God because they were made in the image of God. But here, they're trying to usurp God's authority. They're saying, we're going to get so high, we're going to be God. Right? You see that? That's the first thing that's wrong. The second thing that's wrong is to let us make a name for who? For ourselves. Let us make a name for ourselves. Now, there's a big, big conversation today about name, image, and likeness, if you follow college sports and all this stuff. But when they say that they want to make a name for themselves, they want them to be recognized for what they did. They want the attention to be on them. And they are trying to get to and be like God in a way that's different from their image of God likeness. See, they wanted this to be about them. They wanted to image to the world themselves. They wanted the world to look at the tower and go, "Hey, that Nimrod, he's a good dude, right? Wow, what an amazing, mighty hunter he is." They wanted this to be about their glory, not God's glory. They made it about their fame, their renown, not the God who literally created the whole earth. Guys, you discovered bricks. Like, this is not that great. You know what I mean? Like, this is your claim to fame is bricks? God spoke the world into existence. Do you see this? They're making it about their name, and God's going, "Bricks? Really?" Number three reason that what they're doing is wrong. First, they want to usurp God's authority. Second, they want it to be about them. And third, they do not want to be what? Scattered. They don't want to be dispersed and fill the earth. They don't want to fill the earth with the image of God. They don't want to fill the earth with the knowledge of God and the expanse of creation. They want to do what they want to do. They're in direct disobedience to God's commands. They're called to what? Go. To scatter. To fill the earth. And what are they doing? No, they're congregating. They're staying together and they're doing what they want to do. Every single one of these three point to the clear sin of pride, of arrogance, of thinking that they are better, they are more important, they're thinking more highly of themselves than they ought to think. They think that we get to define what is good and right and best and true, not God. We don't have to listen to what you say. We'll do what we want to do. And if we want to build a tower, by golly, we're going to build a tower made of bricks. And they are in direct disobedience. They think that they can define who they are, their nature, their character, outside of God, outside of His world. And so they built this tower, this probably winding staircase tower. And I don't know how tall it is. You can go look online. Lots of different people guess and different sizes or whatever. But it doesn't seem to be in the heavens based on the next verse. Look at the next verse, verse 5. It says, "And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, Behold, they're one, and they all have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them." See, God was aware of what was going on, and Moses makes it clear that God had to what? He had to come down. their magnificent tower that they're so proud of, what did God have to do? He had to stoop down to even see it. Oh, cool, little bricks, nice. You guys, whoa, how'd you do that little part over there, you know? Like, he's making fun of them. He's laughing at their tower in the heavens by God having to stoop down and look at it. See, even the things that we think are so massive, the things that we maybe even build our own lives on, the things that we think are so important, the God of the universe has to stoop down and look and go, "Oh, you figured out brick, guys. Way to go." Right? The things that we think are the most important, God is so much bigger. And see, God sees what they're doing, and He sees their human hearts that are full of sin, the pride that has consumed them, the arrogance that they have. And God, in His mercy in this moment, He decides to judge them, to stop what's going on and put boundaries in place so that their sin cannot multiply and fill the earth like it did previously. When they can speak the same language, when they can form these technologies and do these things, like, sin is about to run rampant. And God, in His mercy, comes and He confuses their languages. I don't know exactly how this happens. I don't know if, like, is that the moment Chinese was created? Or is that the, I don't know even if these are modern languages, but they are not able to understand one another. I don't know, have you ever tried to communicate with somebody that doesn't speak your language? Anybody in the room? Yeah. I lived in Spain for a time, and I did not speak Spanish. And I lived in a house where all they spoke was Spanish. And it did not take long to be frustrated. Because my family's frustrated with me that I don't understand what they're saying. And I'm frustrated with them that they can't tell me what's going on. And we're just frustrated with each other all the time. And what happens, that frustration builds into a resentment. And you start to assume the worst in the other person. I assume, because you're speaking Spanish to me very quickly, that you're mad at me. Not true. But that's what I begin to assume. And they assume that because I'm speaking English very rapidly at them, there becomes this animosity. There becomes this confusion and this frustration. And what happened was, humanity was no longer able to build this tower. It forced them. They could not communicate. No matter how many scratches on the walls and on the ground that they could do, it forced them to go into all the earth. Now, what's interesting, later in Acts, God is going to begin to reverse this curse that we cannot communicate with every person, right? On the day of Pentecost, the Spirit comes and he gives them the ability to do what? To speak in other languages, to communicate with one another, right? And one day in heaven that will be fully realized. I don't think in heaven we're going to all stand around and listen to other languages. I think we're all going to be able to communicate together in worship of our God. I don't know if that's English, Japanese, whatever. It doesn't matter. One day we will be unified again. But our unity will be directed to God, not to ourselves. And so God, in this moment, he scatters them. He humbles them. And he calls the place Babel. It's a Hebrew word. It's a play on words here. And it means confusion in Hebrew. But they called it, Bablim was the name that they called it. And that meant gate of God. In their mind, this was the most impressive, most God-honoring thing that could ever be. And God calls it Babel, confusion, right? He takes what their biggest accomplishment was and he says, that is nothing compared to me. As we read this story and we see these themes playing out, as we see how sin has infected the human heart and how it's breaking down everything, how it's manifesting itself in pride, in violence, in brokenness, in all sorts of things, it's easy at this moment to go, is it ever going to be better? Is there ever going to be a solution to this? Because when we're left unchecked as humanity, what happens? We break it. We tear it down. We divide. We hurt people. Things seem very bleak in this moment because God has started over, and what's happened? Humanity has united itself against God. This seems without hope. It seems very broken. But every time that Genesis lays out the problem, lays out our sinfulness, it begins another recounting of a lineage. And here's how chapter 11 ends. Look at verse 10. It begins to recite another lineage, reminding them of the hope that one day there will be a son. And here's what it says. Verse 10, these are the generations of Shem. And when Shem was 100 years old, he fathered Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after he fathered Arpachshad 500 years and had other sons and daughters. And he goes on and talks about their sons and sons and sons. And eventually, look at verse 26. We get to a man named Terah. This is when Terah had lived 70 years, he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. And the name of Abram's wife was Sarai. And the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah. And the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was barren. She had no child. Verse 31. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, and his sons, Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. And when they came to Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Every time that there's a massive problem presented in Genesis, God counters it with a lineage and a covenant. And this lineage continues to a man that we're introduced at the end of chapter 11, a man named Abram. His name means father. His name means father. There's only one problem. What does it say about his wife, Sarai? She had no child. It seems pretty bleak. Now, Shane's going to preach chapter 12 next year, how God steps in and how God is going to use Abram to bless all the nations. Abram is going to be the key to how God saves his people. Now, why does all this matter to us today? 2025, where we live. It matters to us because you and I are no different than the family of Adam. We're no different than the family of Noah. We're no different than any one of these people that we have read about. We too are prone to live our lives for ourselves, for our name. We are so prone to go, let us make a name for ourselves. We are prideful. We think This is all about us. We're so proud of our little brick tower that we built with our life, right? We are no different than these. We think this is all about us. And as we read this story, the question we should be asking ourselves is this: what am I building with my life? What am I building with the talent and the energy and the technology that God has given me? What am I spending my time building? Is it a tower that is for my name? Who am I making a name for? Am I living my life for God, or am I living my life for myself? You see, there's a godly way to build your life, and there's an ungodly way to build your life. There's a godly way to spend your time, talents, and energies, and there's an ungodly way to spend your time, talent, and energies. And when we as humanity try to be autonomous and say, no, this is about me, this is about what I get, when we try to separate from God, we try to define what is good and evil instead of what God says is good and evil. What it ends up is a world of violence, a world that is broken. But when we submit to God and we say, this is all about you, everything you've given me is all about you, and if you call me to build a tower, I'll build it for your name, right? When we do that, when we submit to what God says is good and what God says is evil, what God does is he flourishes humanity. He builds us up. And the story so far is this, and the story so far in our lives is this. God continues. If you're alive today, he continues to give us a chance. He continues to give us a chance to do what is right in this world, to live according to his way. And the truth of it is this: many of us continue to mess that up. We call that sin. And it breaks the world down. And some of us who have received Christ and been given new hearts, we more often than not, we're choosing the good when the Spirit enables us to. See, this is the solution that ultimately is going to have to come. God's got to give me a new heart. God's got to give you a new heart, because if I'm left to myself, I'll make anything about me. I'll worship anything besides God, because my sinful heart wants that more than anything. I need a new heart, and that's why Jesus came. He came, yes, to save us from our sins, to die on the cross in our place, but he came to give us a new heart that longs and desires to live in God's way and to obey him in all things. Let me pray. God, just forgive us where we have made this about us. We've made our lives and our talents and our families and our money and our stuff, our bricks about us and our fame and our name. God, forgive us where we've thought more highly of ourselves than we ought. God, forgive us when we've not gone to make disciples, but we've stayed and we've huddled together in order to feel better about ourselves. God, I pray that you just forgive us, God, where we've made our lives about us and not about you. God, I pray that you would give us a new heart. God, pour out your Spirit into our heart, God, and save us and redeem us, God, but give us a new heart that desires to live according to your way, in submission to you, doing what you want us to do, not just what we want to do in our flesh, God. God, we can't do that on our own. No flood can change that. No judgment can change that. Only you can change that, God. We need a new heart desperately. And so I pray today for those who've never put their faith in you, to give them that new heart. God, I pray that you would save and redeem them today. God, I pray that you would rescue from the clutches of sin and death, God, and you would bring them out, plant their feet on solid ground, God. God, I pray that you would just forgive us this morning, God, where we have failed you, God. We love you, and we need you, and we pray all this in your Son's name. Amen.